Did you know that in 2021, 25% of Canadians and 57% of Americans reported having more mental stress than last year? Stress affects focus, decision-making, follow-through, and ability to see the forest for the trees. Let's bring some calm and order into our lives, shall we? Productivity Toolkit 2022 to the rescue. Our toolkit can bring you a breath of fresh air for better focus, help you organize and get systematic. You get 12 actionable templates to use immediately, and you're invited to quarterly workshops about how to apply each tool now. With the 2022 Productivity Toolkit, you get 24/7 access to all the templates and tips on how to use them. This year, I divided the toolkit into four key themes focused on systems: power of one, power of two, power of team, and the power of scale. I know you will love them. Here's what one customer had to say about last year's toolkit. I thoroughly enjoy your productivity tutorial sessions. They help me bring a lot of improvement to my daily routine. I use some of these tips and the templates with my staff, and we are all the better for it. So get in on the VIP advanced launch by heading over to shiftworkplace.co/productivitytools. That's shiftworkplace.co/productivitytools.
Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. I'm really interested in our podcast guest today. He has a unique lifestyle. His name is Richard Matthews, and he is the founder of Push Button Podcasts and FiveFreedoms.io. Richard's obsession with business, sales, and marketing started when he was 9 years old, the day his dad came home from work and handed him a shiny new copy of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which he read in one night and was hooked. Pretty impressive for a nine-year-old. Fast forward to 2021, Richard Matthews has been helping clients build heroic brands, and he's helped clients add more than six figures each year to their business using the techniques that he developed over time. Today, Richard Matthews is living a location, time, and financially free lifestyle as a serial entrepreneur and full-time adventurer. He travels around the U.S. with his wife, four kids, and a big black poodle in their RV. People wonder how he's able to grow his businesses while being constantly on the go, and the answer is that by building automated workflows, documenting systems and processes, and of course, through the help of full-time staff members, he can make it all happen. So welcome, Richard. I'm so glad you could be here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm looking forward to your answers to the questions, and I may digress and go down a rabbit hole here and there, depending on what interesting things you say. I don't think I have ever had a full-time adventure on the podcast, and I'm really looking forward to that part when we get to it in the podcast interview. So why don't we start by you telling the audience a little bit more about who you are and what you do that's outside of the formal bio.
Probably the most important aspects of my life. I am a husband and father of four young children from 2 to 11. My oldest is a boy and the younger three are girls. And we have been traveling full time since May of 2017. So we're in our fifth year right now. We had our fourth baby in Texas. And I have, since the time we started traveling, 4x'd the size of my business, both in size of our team and the amount of revenue that we're pulling in and a number of clients that we're serving. And I've also started working with an e-commerce brand that I'm the COO of. So we've managed a lot while traveling in a small, tiny home and sort of, I don't know what you'd say, maybe proving that you don't have to follow all the rules that society sets out for us.
Exactly. You can set your own road down the highway of life, which is what this sounds like. That's what you've done. So where were you born originally?
Tri-City Hospital in Oceanside, California, which is fun because one of my younger cousins is actually working in that hospital now as a nutritionist.
Full circle.
Yeah.
And let me ask you a little bit about your childhood. So can you share a couple of incidents from your childhood that you believe made you into the person you are today?
Yeah. So I was thinking about this question when you sent it over. It reminds me of that Disney movie, the one where they have the little emotional characters in their head and like their foundational memories is part of who they are. And I was trying to think, you know, what are some of my foundational memories? And I've got a lot, but a couple that stand out. And one that I wanted to share with you was, so my grandmother passed away about 5 years ago, and I was asked to give her eulogy. And it was an interesting experience because I was the oldest of the grandchildren and had a really tight relationship. And the way that I approached giving the eulogy It was kind of surprising because I showed up at the funeral and there's like 700 people there. And it kind of blew me away because, like, to me, she was always just grandma, right? And she was there at the family dinners and the holidays. And, you know, I went over to spend the night at her place and she taught me how to cook and sew and do all those kind of things. She was just grandma. But you find out when a funeral like that happens that she had a massive impact on her community, that so many would show up to see her. And so the way I approached that eulogy was I told the stories that I had. I was like, I don't know her as a mother. I didn't know her as a businesswoman. I didn't know her as a leader of the community. The only thing I knew her as was grandma. So I told several stories of her being my grandmother. And one that I told that is probably one of the things that really has set me on the path of who I am as a father and as a person was something that happened when I was 7 or 8 years old. Her and my mother both are very into knickknacks. So decorations that you have all over your house on your end tables and on the walls. And they've always got cool stuff from their travels and other things that they did. And one day I was running through her house and I knocked over a vase and found out later it was a very expensive vase that I knocked over and it shattered all over the floor. And for my grandmother running into the room and scooping me up and sitting me on her lap. And I was all upset because I knew if I had broken the vase at my mom's house, I'd have been in trouble for weeks. Right. And she sat me down on her lap and she said, "It's only a vase. The only thing that's important to me is that you're safe." And I remember later, my mom sat me down and she was like, "You don't know this, but that was a very rare, very expensive vase that I had broken." And so she's like, "I need you to be more careful in your grandmother's house when you're running around." So my mom told me my grandmother never even mentioned it. In her mind, it was worthless compared to her relationship with me and my safety. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. That's really beautiful because that reinforces your sense of you having a unique contribution and being you as being cherished above all else, which is wonderful.
Yeah. And so it was when my mom informed me the value of what I broke, that it really struck home with me and became sort of a foundational memory in my life, that the way that it's grown over the years in my head is that human beings have a unique and intrinsic value that you just can't ignore, right? It's one of the reasons why the U.S. has been such a successful country is because we recognize that all men are created equal, right?
Well, it's a success for some people, depending on the color of your skin and a whole bunch of other things. Social class and what community you're born into and whether you have supportive people around you like you did. So for sure, it can be successful for some, not so much for others.
Yeah.
What about when you got a little bit older? So when you were a teenager, anything that stands out then in your mind?
Like foundational memory wise?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. My teenage years were interesting. Everything from starting my first business to my parents going through a divorce and having a teacher who really helped me see that through and some other things. But probably one of the more impactful moments was business related. And it sort of set me on the path I am now for running businesses and doing what I do. And that was after I had read several of those Robert Kiyosaki books, probably about 13, freshman in high school, and convinced my dad that he should give me a loan for $50. And I told him I'd pay it back 10% interest, $55 when I was done or something like that. And a ride to the big box store, right? Which in our town was a Smart and Final, which is kind of like a miniature Costco, if you're familiar with the Costcos.
Mm-hmm.
And I had him take me to this Smart and Final and I spent $50 on giant candy bars, right? So like big Snickers and big 100 grand bars and those giant 2 foot long nerd ropes and other things that we couldn't get on campus. And I filled my backpack up with those things and took them to campus and started a candy selling business out of my backpack, like the quintessential guy in New York who's got the fake Rolex watches under his coat. I was like opening my backpack and showing people my wares and sold all of my stuff and made quite a bit of profit, which was fun. Where the whole foundational memory comes in is the end of that first round of candy. And I sold it all and I had all my money. So I owed my dad the loan money. So I gave him back the loan money, which was $55. And then I need to replenish my stock so I could continue to sell. And dad made me pay for gas this time. And so I replenished my stock. And when it was all said and done, I had a bag full of candy. I had no loan with my dad and I had no money. And I was really confused because at that point in my life, I didn't understand the difference between gross revenue and profit.
Uh-huh.
And I had made good money, gross revenue, but I had to pay all of the money back in COGS in the debt payment that I owed my dad.
Cost of goods sold for anyone who doesn't know what that is.
And I remember having to sit down because like my dad wasn't a business person. He was an employee. So he didn't really have a way to explain what was happening in my head. So I like start flipping back through the business books and I went to Barnes & Noble and I was like, I don't understand. How did I start this business and make no money? And that's when I got my first real lesson in business, which was that you have to actually know how your numbers work from gross revenue and gross profit and your cost of goods sold and cost of labor and all that stuff and learn how to actually manage within those constraints, right? The money that comes in top line is not the money that you get to go and stick in your pocket. Learned that lesson at 13 years old, which I thought was pretty good for later in my life, looking back on it. It was a powerful lesson to learn at such a young age.
It really is. So many people don't learn that even after years of being in business, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that that also speaks to your capacity to solve problems and to look ahead for where the systems are. Really, that's a great story. We had another guest on the Cultural Leadership Connections podcast. Her name is Carla Briones, and she was in Mexico with her dad, who is also an entrepreneur. And he did something similar with candy. He said, you want to sell candy, then you're going to have to pay me back. You're going to have to pay interest. That exactly that sort of thing. But what she decided to do was immediately to sell it at twice the amount of money that she bought it for. And she did so well with the candy selling business that the principal of the school called her father and said, tell your daughter to shut down her candy business because our cafeteria has lost too much money.
Yeah, I had the same kind of thing happen. I was called into the principal's office after about 6 weeks of selling and told that I was not allowed to sell on campus without a business license and that I couldn't get a business license until I was 18. I tell people now that I had my first government shutdown at 13.
Yeah, exactly. You both did, which is actually another really good lesson, because the thing is, things may be going great, but that doesn't mean there isn't another obstacle around the corner waiting for you.
Yeah,
those are great stories. Thank you for sharing them. So from the groups you're born into, because people are born into a region, they're born into a often, you know, rural or urban, or it can be something in between, a small city. And it's also the land around them. So if they're on the prairies or in mountains or around an ocean on an island, that affects their sense of who they are. So that's something that you might relate to. People typically have a social class that they're born into. They have a race, they have a family, and the family is often really foundational to how they see themselves. And they have languages that they've spoken, places they've been to. But all of those things, it's where did you grow up and what did that teach you about culture and leadership?
Yeah. So let me start with where I grew up. And maybe we can parlay that into what I've learned. I grew up in an upper middle class town in Southern California. So if your audience is familiar with Southern California geography, there's San Diego on the coast in the south, and to the north, there's Los Angeles. And the suburban community for both of those big cities is sort of the valley that runs in between them. It's about 3 hours worth of driving between those two cities. Because they're both such huge population centers, the entire valley from LA all the way to San Diego is a large suburb of the big cities. And so it's like a never-ending suburb of little town after little town. There's never really a break in them. The town that we grew up in was called Marietta, and Marietta is about smack dab in the middle between those two big cities. So about an hour and a half each way to San Diego or LA.
I was there, actually. Yeah.
You've been there, huh?
It's a nice little place, actually.
It definitely was a great place to grow up. And Marietta, for almost my entire childhood, was listed as like the top 10 safest cities in the country, over 100,000 people. So it was a very safe community to live in. And it was interesting because I remember a couple of times in my childhood when they'd have a crime incident of some sort, it would be like big news because, you know, crime didn't ever happen. So when it did happen, like everyone knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting for such a big city, right? For a city that's got over 100,000 people in it to be like that. It's just sort of the way it was. And I'm not sure exactly why it was that way, but we had a very safe community, but it was a city that grew too fast for itself. So I remember in high school, we still all had single lane roads going to our school and stop signs. And the school had 4,500 students that went to it.
Wow.
The school was built for 2,000 students. So it grew so fast. They started having to put us on tracks. Half of the student population would be at school at any given time. And the way they did that was they had A track, B track, C track, and D track of the students. And so A, B, and C would be on school, and then D track would be off of school. And so you had 3 months on, 1 month off, and they would alternate that through the year. So there's always a quarter of the students that weren't on campus. So if I was in D track, I never saw any of the kids from A track. We were essentially not going to the same school because we were never on campus at the same time.
Again, this is about systems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's about systems. So I grew up in that sort of as a number in the machine, right? Because there were so many of them and they were understaffed. Like our school counselors were assigned by your last name. So like I had the M counselor because there were so many students with last names that started with an M. I remember thinking as I was growing up and going through school that when I went to college, I didn't want to go to a college where I was a number. So I ended up picking a very small college that had less than 500 students at it. That overpopulated sort of culture and feel wasn't something that I loved a lot growing up.
But what did it teach you? What did it teach you about yourself? What did you learn in that context?
Yeah, so I learned a number of things. One of them is that when you have such a big school and you have so many like opportunities available, right? So they had, because it was big and because it was an upper middle class community, there was just everything, right? So there was two or three gymnastics teams and water polo and like everything that was imaginable. And one of the things that I learned in that is that I didn't fit in a lot of the spaces that they were looking for. Because one of the things that was distinctly missing was any sort of interest in the school system about entrepreneurship, which is what I was interested in. And I remember not caring because there wasn't anything that caught my interest. And so like my group of friends, they were the valedictorians and the salutatorians and whatnot. And, you know, they all had above 4.0 GPAs and was the only one in the group that had like a 3.5 GPA because I remember looking at, we were a college preparatory school is what they called us. So all of our classes were taught as if they were college courses. So you get a syllabus at the beginning of the semester with all of your work in it and what they were all worth. And I remember looking at all those things and being like, so you're telling me if I do this final project and get a good grade on it, that's worth 80% of my grade. So I could do that in a few of these tests throughout the year and I'll get in 95 and I'll be good. And the rest of it's just busy work.
Good for you. I figured that out when I was in high school too. It wasn't in a big school like that, but it was like, okay, most of this is crap. So let me see what I need to do to make it work and go for that. And then the rest of the time, do the things that matter.
That's essentially what I did. So my dad had some rules. He was like, this is the grade point average that if you're over this, I won't say anything to you. You can do what you want. So I hit those numbers and then had the rest of the time to myself and worked on things like starting my first candy business. And I got a job when I was a junior in high school and paid for my own car and a motorcycle and learned the whole trap of like, now that I have a car, I have to have the job to pay for the car. And I got the job to get the car. And you know, that whole consumer trap that I learned about early on.
I'm good. I want to get to the consumer trap in a minute, but I just think you really learned how to use what was there to get to your own goals. It seems to me that that's what you learned from this. You looked at it, you went, I'll take this. I don't really like that. And let me see how I can make this work for me, right?
That's really sort of what happened. And it's interesting. And I think one of the things that has struck me the most about it is most of my high school friends that I had, and this is, I think this is probably common for a lot of people, is once you leave high school, you know, you sort of feel like high school is your everything and these people and the relationships and everything, you know, when you graduate are going to last forever. But you find out afterwards that high school is really temporary, if that makes sense. And a lot of the relationships, everyone sort of goes on and goes to their own things in areas that they care about. High school is the last sort of thing that you're forced to do as a child. It's interesting because I have very little connection with a lot of my high school buddies just because we've been in vastly different places and gone in vastly different directions. I don't know. It's an interesting experience to look back on where I grew up because I basically left my hometown as soon as I graduated.
Yeah. Anything else in there? Because there are other things in the groups that you're born into, right? Did you have a religious background? Were there other interests that your parents had? You know, like what other things influenced you?
So there's a couple of things. You mentioned race a little while ago and being from California. One of the things that's unique about California is extremely representative of all the various cultures and languages and whatnot. So my friend group in high school, there was maybe two or three of us that were white guys, one guy who was a black guy, a couple of one Filipino and a Mexican guy. And they were all second generation from their parents who had immigrated. So they all spoke English natively and whatnot. And that wasn't just my friend group. It was everyone's friend group because that's the way the school was. And it was just natural for, you know, all the way from elementary school, middle school, high school, this whole thing. And I remember when I left high school and went to college in the Midwest, and the Midwest is not that way. So the Midwest in the US is very densely populated with white and black and not so much for almost anything else. And I remember the school that I went to, I remember being there for probably 2 months before it dawned on me that the reason it felt so strange is that there was only one black guy in my whole school. And he's one of my good friends and was all the way through my college career. But it was very strange to go from a very multicultural city growing up, moving to a not multicultural city in college.
Well, that's a characteristic of California, as it's not segregated in neighborhoods in the same way that it is in many other states. So it's likely that you will meet people from different races and cultures and be friends with them and not live that far away from them either, which is a really great characteristic of California, just generally in the state, you know? If they're second generation immigrants, you've got parents and grandparents who worked hard so that their kids could then succeed, and they had very high expectations academically. So they would have sent them no matter what to the best school they possibly could. So again, you're getting a mixture of people from a lot of backgrounds, but all that strong academic bent. Yet you continued with your entrepreneurship self.
All of my friends, we'd always go to each other's houses and things like that. And so I knew all of their parents, and their parents all knew me. And I remember my Mexican friend, his parents were both entrepreneurs, and his dad was a glass worker. And then he started a glass business. And I remember when I'd go over to his house, he always had cool little knickknacks that he had made out of glass. There was like a cactus that he had cut out of glass and other things. And I remember being struck by how hardworking he was. And the same thing, my Filipino friend, his mom was wonderful. She cooked great food. And I love the way that they're just very different culturally than we were. And so I grew up around all of that. And so never really had any of those cultural sensitivities.
It's more like you had ways to integrate with people from a variety of different backgrounds without it scaring you away, right?
Which is probably why I like traveling so much now.
Probably.
So it was a lot of fun. And then I guess probably the other influential thing, right? So that was sort of like culturally, it was very diverse. And then I grew up in a religious household as well. So I remember on campus, I was a member of the Christian club. And I remember I became a member of the Christian club, not because I felt I needed to, but because I remember the guy who was in charge of it was just such a friendly person. He ended up becoming a mentor of mine for many, many years. And I was very introverted and shy as a high school student and younger, which was interesting for someone who was entrepreneurial as I was. I remember the way that he would interact with a whole group of people. And when they would do things on campus, it was probably second half of my freshman year after watching the Christian club do several things, and they would do like silent plays on campus and other things, which were super cool. And watching the leader of that group, and I remember thinking, I need to be able to do what that guy does. And I remember that was my impetus for joining the club, right? I went to church and stuff all like that, so I had no religious clash or anything like that. And I remember thinking to myself, I need to know what that guy knows, because I could tell he had an impact, right? When he talked to people and when he helped them with things, it changed their lives. And I was like, he has something that I don't have. And I recognized early on that the thing that he had is he had the ability to have a relationship with someone. And I learned later that the stronger the relationship, the stronger your ability to influence someone is. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that if I was ever going to make it in life, influence was probably one of the most important skills I had to learn how to develop.
Yeah. And influence comes from the relationship that you have, and that relationship influence going together. Did you ever read the books by Francis Bacon, Power and Influence? Really speak to the things that you're talking about. And especially given your multicultural surrounding as you were growing up, talks about how different cultures influence and their communication styles influence, and how relationships are built within a context of working towards a goal like a business or an institution. I think you'd like them.
I remember thinking at that age, I was like that weird kid who'd be in the back, and I would like interact with things, and I would take notes on like what I was doing. And then the next day I would go and practice those things. And I learned the same thing from my mother. My mother was a very social butterfly type person. And I'd watch her when we would have dinners or go places. She could walk into a room and she could have a conversation with anyone. And I remember a couple of times when I would actually took notes, and it goes back to my sort of baseline. My podcast is called The Hero Show, and we talk about, you know, people's superpowers. My superpower is sort of in that realm of being able to see the systems behind things.
It is, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So I was not naturally extroverted, but what I was capable of doing, what I was doing at the time, is I was taking notes on that system that they were using to be extroverted, and then learning to implement those things and practicing them. I had to practice to become extroverted. I had to practice to be able to speak and be able to tell stories. And one of the things that I learned early on from those early influences was that one of the keys of building relationships is the ability to tell stories. And so one of the things I tell people now is that you can judge a relationship based on how much of the other person's story you know, right? So if you just know their name and you don't know any stories, we call that an acquaintance. Mm-hmm. And if you know their name and you know some of their stories, you might call that a friend. Right. Now, if you go further and you get to a point where you're like, I know all of this person's stories, and the only way that we're going to get to have more stories together is if we go out and create something together. Right. If we go out and have adventures together or do something, we have to create new stories. You might call that a best friend. Right. And you get to a point like your spouse, or my wife, for instance, my wife knows all my stories, and she knows if I change a detail. Right. And the only way that we can make our relationship deeper is to continue to create new stories together and have new experiences together and things like that.
I really love this analogy of the relationship with how many stories you know about the person. That's a really great takeaway already from this podcast, is that just that thought, you know, like if you don't know someone well enough to be able to speak to some of their stories, well, then you really don't have a deeper relationship. You may think you do, but you don't. So, yeah. And then when you're married to someone, you have a lot of stories. You have so many stories in common that you even think the same thoughts at the same time.
True.
Yeah.
But one of the most interesting things about that is it gives you, I hate to use the word hack, but it's how you hack relationships. If you want to build a relationship, the easiest way to do that is to learn the other person's stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I tell people the easiest way to build a relationship is to be curious and ignorant, right? Which is, even if you know a lot about a subject, ask the other person about their stories, find out who mm-hmm. they are and where they're from and what they like. And there's always some super easy go-to story places. Like, what was, you know, your biggest injury as a child? Everyone loves to share their big injury stories. And mm-hmm. whatever they are, your most fun adventure. Like, and the more of someone else's story that you get to hear, the better you know that person. And all you have to do is listen, and you can develop a deep relationship. And the other half of that is sort of the expectation is, if someone shares a story, you share a story back. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I've learned is I practice the different stories, like the story I told about starting my business at 13. I've told that story probably 1,000 times, and I know exactly the high points and the low points and what the things are that I like to share. And you can practice your stories. And I like to think of life as like a version of the stand-up comedians, right? Where they stand up because they're like masters of storytelling. And my wife thinks I'm nuts, but I'll sit down and we'll watch stand-up comedians, and I'll watch them with a notebook, and I'll take notes how they transition from one story to another, or how they move in into and out of stories, and what kind of things they detail and highlight.
That's because you're keenly observing human behavior and seeing what you can learn from it, which is really brilliant. I want to move to the next question, which is, you have a very distinct desire to become an entrepreneur, to study human behavior, to figure out systems, and you've developed that, which I'm pretty sure was part of who you are, which we'll get to in a bit. But about groups that you chose to belong to, what have you learned from groups that you then adopted? I mean, you did learn from the mentor that you were talking about, you know, you took notes on how to build relationships, how to become extroverted, that sort of thing. But what about from, is there a group that has influenced you?
Let's fast forward a number of years to when we actually went onto the road. And one of the most impactful groups that I've been a part of is a group called Full-Time Families. And Full-Time Families is a group of people the world over that travel full time with their families. And come to find out, before we did it, there's a lot of people who choose what we chose to do with them and not have what we call in the full-time families community a sticks and bricks house. We don't have one of those, which is very abnormal the world over. And one of the things that has made traveling something that has been long-term for us is access to and the availability of that kind of a community, right? A community of people that we got to choose to be a part of. And in our case, it's everything from ways to connect with people. There's like Facebook groups for the different areas of our country, and there's places all over the world that you can meet up with full-time travelers. But then also, when you are at places, we have a little flag that is part of the full-time family community that has got our name on it. And we stick it out in front of our RV when we're stopped at places to let other families know that, hey, we're here, we're part of that full-time traveling group. And what's interesting is over the last 4 or 5 years, some of our closest relationships and friendships with other families have come from that group. And I'll just tell one quick story about that. We're probably 1.5, 2 years into traveling, and we're in Conroe, Texas. And Conroe was just north of Houston, for those of you who are not familiar with Texas. But we were there at Conroe and staying for several weeks. I think we were going to be there for like 6 weeks. And I remember it was our second or third day there, and another family pulled in right next to us. And I could tell from watching them, this was their first time, or one of their first couple of times with a trailer. And so after they got their whole trailer pulled in and all set up, my wife and I went over there and introduced ourselves to them. They had a couple of kids that were our kids' age. And so we introduced ourselves and said hi, and shared a little bit of stories back and forth. It was their first day on the road. They were moving full time. And we invited them over for dinner. And sort of one of the rules that we've learned on the road is, when you're traveling, you don't have time to wait to build a relationship, right? Because if you wait, they might be gone tomorrow. So you only have now. And so that had become very normal for us to meet someone and then invite them over for dinner, right? And, you know, have a fire and have a cookout and roast marshmallows and get to know each other, right?
Yeah, the ultimate in being in the moment and being present to what opportunities are available.
Yeah, so we had them over for dinner, and fast forward 3 or 4 years, they're one of our closest friends, and we've traveled all over the country together, and our oldest sons are constantly playing games together and whatnot, even when we're in different parts of the country. And I remember a couple of years ago, the husband was like, you know, the first time that you guys came over and invited us over to dinner, it freaked me out, because I was like, I had never met someone, and then within moments of them meeting them, having them invite us over for dinner, he's like, that was really odd to me. And he was like, it was like a system shock, because that is not a typical thing culturally in the US, at least, to go straight to let's have dinner, let's get to know each other, that kind of stuff. I mean, he's like, but it was a really cool introduction to the full-time families community, right? Mm-hmm. Where you are able to connect with each other. And the thing that I wanted to bring out of that story is that, like, that is a very typical part of the full-time families community, is that you only have today, right? And I know that we hear that a lot, to live like today is the last day that you have. And it's very ethereal, right? It's hard to grasp onto that because we don't look at our lives as if we are mortals, right? We don't look at our lives that way. And so it's interesting to be able to pull that into your own reality with something that's more tangible. And that more tangible reality is that, hey, we're only going to be here until tomorrow. Literally, we're going to get in our RV and live and move somewhere else tomorrow, right? And same is the case with the other person. So you only have the day to actually interact with someone. And you realize when you're traveling that if you don't take the time and the effort to build those relationships and to take those time, then you'll be very lonely on the road. And all the people that we've seen come onto the road and start traveling and not last very long, right? Because it's a difficult kind of lifestyle to get used to, is that's generally the thing that gets them to leave, is they don't know how to sort of integrate into a mobile community, right? Mm-hmm. And have the relationships that way. It's easier to do when you're stationary, because even as a family with four kids, if it's just you guys and you're never interacting with other families and being a part of a community and part of a culture, it gets lonely. So you have to be very intentional and very specific about how you do that. Hopefully that's an interesting story about how culture impacts sort of everything.
Yeah, I really, really like the example. It brings me to a couple of other questions. One is that, so there are communities where people are not, you know, like there've been gold digging communities, right? There've been oil and gas communities where people come in from all over the world and they make friends, and then those friends leave, and then they leave. And so people have often told me that they just stop trying to make friends with people because they're going to lose that relationship. But what you just said flies totally in the face of that. You don't lose the relationship. You can make the friendship quickly and you can maintain it over time. The relationship doesn't die.
Yeah.
Just because you're not in the same place doesn't mean the relationship is gone.
Absolutely. So there's three aspects to that. There's levels of relationship. Right. We talked about how close you are with someone. And generally speaking, people don't have a lot of room for a lot of really deep relationships, a couple of families or a couple of other people that you have really deep relationships with. And then like that next level down, you have a lot more room for. And what's interesting is the ones that you have the deep relationships with. And I think this is where some of that struggle comes in, is people think that they have to have that deep level of relationship with everyone or not worth it. And it's just not the case.
No, it's not possible.
It's not possible. So you have a few, right? And we've got a few. We've got a couple of families, probably three, one that I've had since college and a couple that we've met on the road, that we've got really tight relationships with, and that we expend a exorbitant amount of effort making sure we stay connected when we're not in the same place. Like as an example, right now we have three extra kids in our house because we're borrowing three of them from a close friend who is renovating their house so they can move on to a yacht and travel. So we're like, hey, we'll borrow your kids for a few weeks so you can just finish up the renovations without little feet running around. And so you go extra lengths for those close relationships. But some of the relationships we've met on the road that are in that sort of next level, you can keep up with them at a lot more casual way.
Right.
And when you end up back in the same place again, it's like you can set that relationship down on the shelf and then pick it back up again as soon as you guys are close. You can keep tabs on each other. Like, hey, it looks like you're going to be in Texas, you know, in 6 months, and we're going to be there in 6 months. Like one of the things we're planning is one of our groups that has second level friendships in it is a couple of years ago, we all did a couple of weeks at the Texas Sand Fest, which is one of the largest sandcastle festivals in the world. And we're all going to try and be there this October to go do it again. And so we have seen a lot of them for a couple of years, but we're all very excited to get back and go do something like that again. And I know that we'll be able to pick those relationships back up almost where you left them off. The things that are strange about that is the kids, right? Because if you haven't seen their kids in a couple of years, they're drastically different. But the adults don't change that much. But yeah, you can definitely keep up relationships, especially nowadays. Technology makes it even easier. Mm-hmm. My son and I are actually in the middle of learning videography and storytelling for our YouTube channel on traveling. And so we're doing a video right now on how he makes and keeps friends on the road. And we did all sorts of stuff. Like we have him doing Harry Potter spells where he apparates onto his scooter and drives away and turns a Lego into a helmet to put onto his head.
I'm going to put that in our show notes because that's going to be really interesting for people to go back to.
Yeah, to watch. But anyways, we're not done with that video. We're just sort of experimenting. But what's interesting is like he has a whole system that he follows. And so when we did the video, I started taking notes with him. I'm like, okay, so what do you do here? And what do you do there? And how do you keep up with them? What do you connect? So we actually turned it all into a step-by-step of like what he actually goes through to find friends when we go to a new spot.
the way you figure out these systems is like the user experience interview, right?
Yeah.
So then what you do, okay, now what are you feeling? Okay, now what's going on in your mind? Okay, and then what happens?
Yeah. And so I just sat down with him for a couple of hours and walked through the whole thing and everything down to, like, you know, when he looks for bikes and he looks for small chairs and he looks for the full-time family's flags. And, you know, he waits for the parents to be home and goes up and knocks on the door and says hi. And he tries to find something that they're interested in, whether that's playing with swords and killing imaginary bad guys, you know, which is a very frequent thing when you have little boys in your house.
Okay.
Or the other day he found a couple of boys that were his age and we were by the ocean and they spent all afternoon throwing mud at each other and catching crabs, right? And that kind of stuff. And he didn't put it in these terms, but they build a relationship and then he finds a way to stay connected with them. So he'll get the parents together, be like, hey, dad, I need you, you know, introduce yourself to the mom or the dad over here. And then because he has to have permission to, you know, get connected with the other kid on like Facebook Messenger Kids. And then he tries to get their screen names for whatever games they're interested in. So he's got a wide interest of games that he's got because he's like, not all the kids are interested in the same games. We've got a snake game and Minecraft and a couple of tower defense games, a few other things that are like that you can play socially over the internet. And so he gets connected with the kids and he's got this whole system that he goes through. Like, he didn't know it was a system until I sat down and actually outlined it for him. We've turned it into a video. But yeah, it's part of that whole building a relationship and being able to pick them up and set them back down. And even as a kid, he can do the same thing.
He puts the relationship into a place where it can continue to live. It's got a home, you know, like puts it into a network with the parents and with the games and with the activities they enjoy doing together. And then that's how he grows it, is through that kind of ecosystem. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. He's got one friend that he just met that's into fire spinning. So fire spinning is like when you have those sticks that are lit on fire and you toss them around. And my son is into poi, which is the ones that are like on a chain that you swing around. And he's been begging me for years to let him light them on fire. And he met this kid the other day at one of the campgrounds that he's already at that point where he's starting to light his stuff on fire. And Zachary wants to get there. And so they connected really hard over that stuff. And actually watching this other kid who's a couple of years older than my son, so he's got a bit better dexterity, I was like, so here's the deal. You notice how he hasn't hit himself in the face with the flaming stick yet. I need you to practice to the point where you can spin the stick or spin the poi and not hit yourself with the flaming ball of doom, right? And I was like, so here's the deal. We've got the stuff, we've got all the equipment, and you know, we happen to run an e-commerce company where we sell fuel for candles and whatnot that also happens to work really well for these flaming sticks. And I was like, for your birthday this year, I bought him the flaming version of the poi. Like, you can practice with these. And if you can show your mom and I to our satisfaction that you don't hit yourself with them, we will let you light them on fire for your birthday. And so him and this other kid have been sending videos to each other because the other kid's more advanced than him. So he's like, okay, I'm struggling with this trick. And he'll set his iPad up and video himself doing this and send it to the other kid who will give him feedback and send another video on like how he's supposed to do it. So they're going back and forth on something that's completely outside of video games, but they're staying connected over that thing in their relationship. Right. So watching him is that people, even over a distance, they have to have something that connects them.
My next question is about temperament and personality. So temperament is what you're born with. And you clearly have a systems focus when you were born, or it emerged pretty quickly. And then you had other kinds of things that were part of your temperament. So what would you say is something that you grew into your temperament that you learned from experience, that your personality grew in, other than the learning to be extroverted? What else did you grow into your personality?
Grow into my personality? That's an interesting question. So you mentioned already the extroverted thing. So I learned that, and that was a difficult thing to pick up. But probably the other thing was learning to be a storyteller. And we talked about that a little bit, but I remember in college learning the importance of that. And it was interesting because the mentor I mentioned in high school, he pulled me aside right before we graduated. And he was like, hey, one of the things I need you to know about yourself, he's like, I know you're not going to be able to understand this yet, but it will happen at some point. You have a unique ability to influence people because you understand how to build relationships on sort of a gut level. And I was like, yeah, whatever. I was 17 at the time. I wasn't paying much of attention to what he was telling me. But he was like, you need to be careful what you say to other people because they'll listen and they'll take what you say and actually change their lives based on it. And again, I sort of dismissed that out of hand. And a few years later in college, it started to dawn on me that the relationships that I was building, a lot of came from that ability to both tell and listen to stories with other people. And I learned quickly, because we lived in like an all guys dorm on campus, that, you know, you'd stay up into the wee hours in the morning talking with someone else, that they started to getting to a point where someone else would really trust you and really start asking you for your opinion and other things. And I remember very clearly one night I had a gentleman who was a couple years older than me and was getting ready to get married. We had spent many, many hours talking about a lot of these things and sharing stories with each other. And he sat down, and he was like, I have some really serious questions for you. He's like, I just want to talk through them. And we talked through a lot of those things and sort of out of hand gave him a lot of my thoughts and advice, which I didn't understand the gravity of giving someone advice until he came back a couple of weeks later. And I realized that he had taken all the advice I'd given him and acted on them like positively. And I remember how much that struck me, that when you build a relationship with someone, which is funny because it was my goal, right? To learn how to build relationships and have influence, is that then you have influence. And influence is sort of this grave responsibility that you have to take seriously. Because if you have influence in someone's life, when you talk to them and you make suggestions or other things, a lot of times people will actually take you up on it and change their lives accordingly, which can be scary. So you have to take that responsibility heavily.
That reminds me of a story of someone that I spoke to a few months ago, who said that when he was in grade school, he had these trading cards, and he was known all over the school for, you know, having the best trading cards, because he very systematically sought out to make good trades so that he would benefit from each of those trades. Kids started following him around, and it's like he was the kind of the trade card guru. And at one point he was eating his lunch and he had yogurt, and the yogurt fell on the floor and split. And one of the kids came up to him and said, you know, I really want that trading card and I'll do anything. And he started licking the yogurt off the floor. And this guy was absolutely horrified. And he thought, I have too much influence here. And he threw all his trading cards away, because he thought, if people are going to debase themselves because of what they want from me, my influence has gone the wrong way.
Yep.
So yeah, you didn't have to go through that negative experience to discover it. You discovered that you gave positive advice, and it was the other person really took it very seriously. But that sure shows you the gravity of what we do. We're all related, indigenous teaching, you know, all my relations, everything that we do affects everybody else. And you certainly saw that when you gave advice to that young man who's getting ready to get married.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about a time when you became aware that your understanding of the world was specific to your culture. Now, you may have noticed early on that it was specific to you because you were interested in entrepreneurship and others were not necessarily in the same way. But what about something that was specific to your group? You mentioned a little bit when you moved to the Midwest and things were very clearly divided between white and black when you'd been in a multicultural environment before that. But is there a time, maybe from that or from another time in your life, when you realized that what you knew was your culture and not just normal for everybody else?
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's a couple of times throughout my life, but I think I have gotten to a point in the business community where I'm starting to be surrounded by people who are radically more successful than myself, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And being invited into those rooms. And I remember one of the first times that I sat in a room like that, and it was a small group, four or five of us. We hit a certain level with our business, and hitting that level in your business sort of opened an invitation. And I was invited into that room with those gentlemen and a couple of ladies. And they were all very interested in the things that I was doing and how I was thinking, because apparently my systematic way of looking at the world is not normal. So they were very interested in some of the things that I was doing. But I remember thinking to myself that I feel like a sixth grader who's learning how to swim in a room full of water polo champions. And it was interesting to me to be in a room like that and have the water polo champions look at me and think, you've got something that I want to know, and we have things that we can teach you. And realizing that, like, some of the things that I struggle with in my business, with everything from like learning how to manage a team or learning how to, like at that point in time when I first got into that room, I didn't have a team. So learning how to expand my business to the point that I did, and now how to manage it and do some of those other things, those were all things that were, to them, they were just normal, right? They're just normal part of their life and how they think and how they act and what they do. And then me looking at all those things and being like, it's so foreign, you know, as you go from what I was to really a CEO or an entrepreneur, and like learning how to make that shift. It's interesting that the cultural shift that happens when you make that change from being a solopreneur to being a CEO, if that makes sense. And I remember how striking that was, to how vastly different they think and how they act and what their priorities are. And so anyways, that was the big cultural differences in the business community that I've run into recently, in the last 3 years.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story. And people don't typically talk about things like that. They talk about other kinds of shifts, but that is a really significant shift because you're learning to think in a different wealth bracket and a different success bracket and a different relationship bracket than you have before. So it's a movement from one plateau to another. So we're almost at the end of the interview. I'm wondering, if people want to work with you, what's the best way to work with you? What do they need to know about working with you that's really important?
Probably the best way to work with me, You mentioned in the intro, we run a business called Push Button Podcasts, which is a full service podcasting agency. So we work with podcasters, or generally we work with small businesses, or even sometimes medium and large businesses that are looking to use podcasting as a marketing medium. And the only problem is podcasting is a very, very time intensive task, which you probably know.
Yep.
And so what we do is we allow businesses to get into podcasting as a marketing medium for their business, with both strategy, but also doing all of the work that goes into it other than the actual content creation, right? So in the case of like an interview like this, the business owner or whoever the head of the marketing department is can run the podcast, the actual interview or the educational stuff. And then our agency takes over and does everything else for them. So we do the file management and we do the backups and the database stuff. And we do all of the show notes and we do all the written content. We do all the graphic content. We do all the social media content. We do all the publication, the announcements, and we do everything, including creating derivative content and getting all that stuff out to actually turn their podcast into a marketing medium. So the best way to work with us generally is to check out our Push Button Podcasts website. We've got a couple of marketing things that are going up over there, educational content that people can check out. That's probably the best way for people to work with us on there. And there was a second part to that question, I feel like, that I missed.
Well, what you just answered was my next question, which is about what you wanted to promote. But the first part is more about you. So if they're working with you, what do people need to know about working with you personally that is just really important to how the relationship evolves?
So working with me, probably the most important thing is, this is weird to say on an interview, but I tell all of my clients at the beginning that they'll always be second in my life. And what I mean by that, my family always comes first.
Yes.
And our lifestyle is mobile and we travel and we do things. So we do work and I work very hard for my clients. But if my kids need me and I'm on a call, I'll tell you I got to go. And we'll pick up and we'll take care of that later, which most of the time, most of my clients, they wish they could do the same thing in their lives. So it's not generally a big thing, but that's one of the first things. So very flexible. But again, it's not just me that you'd be hiring. You're hiring me and my entire staff. If for some reason I'm not available or something like that, my staff will pick things up and make sure stuff is getting done. So despite, I don't know if you'd call that a warning or a thought or whatnot, but yeah, that's the way I treat all of my relationships. And it's something that I learned early on, is that I did not set up good boundaries early in my career. And it led to me letting my clients walk all over me, to the point where like I was answering emails in the middle of the night and working 12 hours a day and things like that, and not being able to give the time that I wanted to give to my family, which is why I started a business in the first place. I've learned to be a bit more militant about that. And what I've found is that it actually ends up where we have better relationships with our clients because we understand each other. Like, we understand what the boundaries are and what the rules are for the relationship. If that makes
sense. You do. Without boundaries, everything's a mess and things don't get done and expectations are all out of whack. So for sure. And that's a great comment. So last question, anything else you'd like to say?
Yeah. One of the things that I say to all of my podcast interviews is take the risk, right? Whatever you're thinking about or wanting to do, take the risk. Jump off the cliff, learn to fly on the way down is what I tell people, right? And we've done that a number of times in our life, everything from my wife and I arranged our marriage to we picked up our business and moved it from the Midwest back to California out of nowhere. And then we sold everything we owned and moved into an RV and traveled. And every one of those decisions, we had to learn to fly on the way down. And it was the ability to take risk and manage it and learn how to accomplish your goals is a muscle you have to work. And you realize after you've done it a number of times that your worst fear are very, very unlikely. Probably your best case scenario is also very unlikely. But what's going to happen is you're going to end up making small progress towards your bigger goals over and over and over again. And eventually you'll look back on your life and you realize that you have accomplished and done more than you ever could have imagined because you were willing to take the risk.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And I really love the learn to fly as you go down, because that's what all birds do. They get kicked out of the nest by their parent birds and they have to learn to fly. So, and that's what you do. And it's great advice to give to everyone else. Thank you so much, Richard, for being on the podcast. I really appreciate your time and your wisdom.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun being here.
I would characterize Richard Matthews as a student of human behavior. He was so fascinated with how people behave that from a young age, he took careful notes on people he admired, detailing how they spoke, carried themselves, interacted, and dealt with situations as they arose. From this intense interest grew an ability to sell and to create systems that speak to and work for real people. His unusual but systematic approach spreads to his living arrangements as an RV nomad family, connecting with fellow wanderlust travelers along the way, running his business virtually from behind a curtain in his RV, and schooling his children on the road as they drive from one travel adventure to another. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with Richard and felt he truly rose to the challenges I peppered him with. Thank you, Richard, for a fascinating interview and for being such a good sport. And thank you, listeners, for being a part of the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast community, which has thousands of members around the world and continues to grow in popularity because you are sharing it. Remember to check out my people skills courses and programs on the shiftworkplace.com website. And make sure you click the link to get into our leadership and career library, which is completely free. May Culture and Leadership Connections continue to guide and inspire your day. This podcast would not be possible without the expertise of our Culture and Leadership Connections production team. A big thank you and shout out to Mike Kurlander for audio production and editing, to Malvika Kathpal for the show notes, Bernadette Guadiz for online web and social media management and promotions, Celine Bayogo for design, and Kirsten Hoyer for website and branding. Thank you so much.